Part 3, Lessons from America's Past and Strategies for the Future. Chapter 16, How Early Americans Decentralized Military Power. Since the Second World War, the American regime has greatly expanded military spending and military operations far above and beyond what had been the case before the war. Many view this as a positive development, and those who favor an active and interventionist posture for American military affairs have frequently criticized American policy before the war as isolationist. More specifically, critics of pre-war policy contend that U.S. lacked the military spending, personnel, and material necessary to meet the needs of defense for the United States in an increasingly globalized world. The charge of isolationism, however, rather exaggerates the U.S.'s military posture before the 20th century, and it is not the case that American policymakers were especially pacifistic before the Second World War. This can be seen in a multitude of military interventions carried out by the U.S. regime in early decades. We can point to full-scale wars, of course, like the First World War and the Spanish-American War. But we can also note smaller-scale interventions, such as those in Korea, 1888 to 1889, 1894 to 1896, the Philippines, 1898 to 1946, and a multitude of interventions in Latin America dating back to the 1840s. What was different about the 19th century, however, was that land-based military forces tended to be much more temporary, ad hoc, and limited in size. This was by design. As with most other governmental prerogatives, the federal government's military powers were decentralized, with most military power to be held within the member states themselves. Many of the early American liberals assumed it was best to decentralize military power to lessen the chances of abuse by a central government. A limit on military capability as a limit on regime power. The idea that a regime's military forces, especially its land-based forces, ought to be restrained was a key component of the ideological program of the classical liberals who had fought in the American Revolution. As Americans debated what ought to be the full extent of federal power, many Americans continued to fear that a strong national government would simply replace the British crown in terms of military might and coercive power. These fears date back at least to the English Civil War and the time of the Levellers, whom Murray Rothbard described as the world's first self-consciously libertarian movement. By the 1640s, Leveller reformers were calling for a decentralized militia system, which would lessen the power of the king in domestic affairs. In The Levellers, Radical Political Thought in the English Revolution, Rachel Foxley writes, in the Third Agreement of the People, in May 1649, the Levellers proposed that armed forces were to be raised strictly by local divisions and officered by men elected locally. Only the general officers were to be appointed by Parliament. John Wildman was to express similar views, in more specifically Republican terms, in the 1650s, opposing mercenary armies in favor of the people being masters of their own arms. The years of civil war would be disorienting in terms of military power, but, as British historian Marcus Cunliffe explains in his History of American Military Institutions, at the restoration of the Stuarts in 1660, both Charles II and Parliament would for different reasons have liked to be rid of the Cromwellian legacy of the New Model Army, but some troops were needed to keep order. A compromise was reached. First, a small regular force was to be maintained. This was the actual foundation of the British Standing Army. Second, there was to be a nationwide militia composed of civilians who would, as in earlier days, be summoned in time of need. The militia, however, was to be under civil law and to be organized locally by the Lord Lieutenant of each county. It was thus decentralized and divorced from royal control. Cunliffe further explains that later American attitudes toward a standing army were adopted nearly wholesale from earlier English attitudes about militias and civil control of the military. These attitudes can be found in the Declaration of Independence itself, which lists among its grievances the fact that the king has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislature and has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. By the time of the American constitutional debates, these concerns were addressed in part by the adoption of what is now known as the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution. Anti-Federalists and other Americans fearful of centralized power in the U.S. government designed the amendment to guarantee that the states would be free to raise and train their own militias as a defense against federal power. These militias were also a means of keeping a defensive military force available to Americans, but which remained outside the direct control of the federal government. In his book, Eagle and Sword, The Federalists and the Creation of the Military Establishment in America, 1783 to 1802, Richard Cohn writes, "No principle of government was more widely understood or more completely accepted by the generation of Americans that established the United States than the danger of a standing army in peacetime. Because a standing army represented the ultimate and uncontrolled and controllable power, any nation that maintained permanent forces surely risked the overthrow of legitimate government and the introduction of tyranny and despotism." We can see this plainly in the speeches and writings of the anti-federalists like Patrick Henry. We see it in the more moderate attendees of the Constitutional Convention as well, such as George Mason, who wrote, "When once a standing army is established in any country, the people lose their liberty." These ideas were further developed at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, where Patrick Henry mocked the idea that liberties could be preserved by simply assembling the people. Without locally controlled military might, Henry noted, federal force could destroy the independence of the state governments. Similarly, George Mason concluded that the militia is our ultimate safety. We can have no security without it. As historian Leon Friedman concludes, the people organized in the state militias were regarded as a counterforce against the threat that the regular army could be used as an instrument of oppression, and service in the militia was a right of the citizen that could not be transgressed by the federal government. Even after the adoption of the new Constitution, opposition to a powerful federal military continued. Congress opposed not only attempts to increase the size of the professional U.S. Army much beyond 1,000 men, but also opposed attempts to mandate any specific training in a federally organized militia system. In the end, opposition to federal control of military affairs meant training of militias was left entirely to the states. This is understandable given the long tradition of the unorganized militia in American history. This notion was recognized by policymakers even before ratification of the federal Constitution, as noted by legal historian David Yaske. As we have seen, in practice, founding-era militias were far from universal, but in the founders' conceptual framework, the militia consisted of the mass of ordinary citizens trained to arms and available to serve at the call of the state. As George Mason put it, "Who are the militia? They consist now of the whole people, except for a few public officers." When the Second Congress sought to exercise its constitutional authority to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, it directed each and every free, able-bodied white male citizen of the respective states, except for persons exempted under state law and certain other exempted classes, who is of the age of 18 years and under the age of 45 years, to enroll in the militia of their states, or, as Patrick Henry declared at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, "The great object is that every man be armed." Far from eschewing the idea of military defense altogether, many states went to great lengths to ensure a large number of armed men were potentially available in case of invasion or general disorder. For example, an 1894 collection of texts from state constitutions show no fewer than 22 state constitutions contained language along the lines of, "The militia of the state shall consist of all able-bodied male residents of the state between the ages of 18 and 45 years." To ensure a ready availability of men used to handling firearms, these constitutional provisions are often accompanied by state guarantees of a right to keep and bear arms, similar to the 1780 Massachusetts Declaration of Rights, which states, "The people have a right to keep and to bear arms for the common defense. And as in time of peace, armies are dangerous to liberty, they ought not to be maintained without the consent of the legislature, and the military power shall always be held in an exact subordination to the civil authority and be governed by it." Ideally, each state would have its own unorganized militia of residents who could aid the civil power in case of civil unrest or invasion. American policymakers took these measures as part of an effort to ensure the federal government would not overwhelm state and local governments. For a long time, the strategy worked. Throughout most of the 19th century, land-based military power continued to be heavily decentralized among the American member states and their militias. The federal government directly controlled only a small force of professional federal officers and enlisted men. This meant that if the federal government wished to carry out any sizable military operations, it required the consent of the member states and their governments. Without this consent, it was impossible to call forth the militias for federal purposes. Member state vetoes on calling forth the militia. While the Constitution of 1787 does not explicitly provide for a member state veto on the federal use of militias, there were historically both statutory and customary barriers to presidents drawing upon local troops without the consent of member state governors and legislatures. In some cases, these member state governments asserted control over their militia troops when federal orders conflicted with the agenda of the member states themselves. For example, during the War of 1812, the governor of Vermont, Martin Chittenden, attempted to recall Vermont troops that had been federalized by the U.S. government and sent to New York. Chittenden declared, "It has been ordered from our frontiers to the defense of a neighboring state and placed under the command, and at that the disposal of an officer of the United States out of the jurisdiction or control of the executive of this state." During the same conflict, the state legislature of Connecticut issued a declaration passed by both houses. It must not be forgotten that the state of Connecticut is a free, sovereign, and independent state, that the United States are a confederacy of states, that we are a confederated and not a consolidated republic. At the time, the governor of Connecticut refused to comply with a requisition of troops from the United States Secretary of War. The governor condemned the federal attempt at nationalizing the militia and wrote, "By the principles of the proposed plan, our sons, our brothers, and friends are made liable to be delivered against their will and by force to the marshals and recruiting officers of the United States, to be employed not for our defense, but for the conquest of Canada." The state assembly concluded that the federal demands were not only intolerably oppressive, but subversive of the rights and liberties of the state, and the freedom, sovereignty, and independence of the same, and inconsistent with the principles of the Constitution of the United States. According to William Chauncey Fowler, writing his book, Local Law in Massachusetts and Connecticut, the governor of Connecticut took the ground that, by the Constitution of the United States, the entire control of the militia is given to the state, except in certain specified cases, namely, to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrection, and to repel invasions, and he contended that neither of these cases actually existed. He also took the ground that the militia could not be compelled to serve under any other than their own officers, with the exception of the president himself, when personally in the field. The state legislature concurred. Kentucky declares neutrality. Another notable case of a state asserting control over its own military resources is Kentucky's insistence on neutrality in the early days of the American Civil War. By 1860, demographic and economic changes in Kentucky had made it a semi-industrialized state with a declining reliance on the slave economy. Kentucky had close economic ties with both northern and southern states. Kentucky Governor Beriah McGoffin opposed secession for Kentucky, yet he also opposed military efforts to force the secessionist states back into the Union. That is, He was unwilling to directly support either the Union or the Confederacy and asserted neutrality in the war. McGuffin announced, "I will send not a man nor a dollar for the wicked purpose of subduing my sister Southern states." And he refused a federal demand for 4 regiments from Kentucky to be added to the Union Army. McGuffin was not alone in neutralist views, and former Kentucky Senator Archibald Dixon urged local citizens to stand firm with her sister border states in the center of the Republic to calm the distracted sections. By this, Dixon claimed Kentucky saves the Union and frowns down secession. Similarly, an assembly of voters in Louisville convened a public meeting on the matter and concluded it was the duty of Kentucky to maintain her present independent position, taking sides not with the Lincoln administration nor with the seceding states, but with the Union against them both. Reflecting on the extent to which Kentucky had separated itself from both the North and the South during this period, Lowell Harrison has suggested that, at the time, a bewildered observer from abroad might well have concluded that the United States had become 3 countries, the Union, the Confederacy, and Kentucky. Predictably, Lincoln himself, who had concluded he must avoid military intervention to force Kentucky's compliance, took a dim view of Kentucky's neutrality, declaring the doctrine of armed neutrality to be disunion completed, while neutrality recognizes no fidelity to the Constitution, no obligation to maintain the Union, and as treason, in effect. Lincoln would eventually obtain political support from Kentucky, but not because he won the constitutional or legal argument. Eventually, Unionists took control of the state government and sided with the Union over the Confederacy. This ended the debate. Nevertheless, the Kentucky case merely continued the established practice of state governments vetoing federal use of state militias and military resources. In the case of Kentucky, the assertion that state governments could prevent federalization of local troops had worked as intended. Unionists, both in Washington and locally, were forced to win political support for the northern side among Kentuckians before state resources could be used to prosecute the war. Technically, Lincoln faced this problem in every northern state, although most state governments willingly sent state-organized troops to the war effort because they were ideologically aligned with the anti-secession movement. Had Lincoln failed to win political support from the individual states, however, he would have lacked the resources necessary to prosecute the war. At the time, the federal government simply lacked the resources necessary to carry on a large military operation of the type needed to invade the southern states. The 20th century, state militias nationalized. By the early 20th century, after a long period during which state governments exercised some level of control over the deployment of state militias, the federal government began to consolidate control over military resources in the states. The first large step toward consolidation came in the form of the Militia Act of 1903, which, for the first time, began the use of the phrase National Guard in federal statutes. This new legislation also paved the way for the use of National Guard units to be used outside the territory of the United States, with a 1906 amendment specifically creating a provision for the use of militia units, either within or without the territory of the United States. This provision was later contested on constitutional grounds, but the Congress responded with the National Defense Act of 1916. Which made it even easier for the president to call up state troops for federal purposes. Over time, the line between state militias and federal troops became increasingly blurred, and today, with the exception of the state defense forces, state National Guard units today do not function independently of the United States government in any meaningful way. The final nail in the coffin of local control came in 1987. Courtesy of Mississippi Congressman Gillespie Montgomery. Montgomery introduced a provision in the 1987 National Defense Authorization Act, which specifically states that the consent of a governor may not be withheld in whole or in part with regard to active duty outside the United States, its territories, and its possessions, because of any objection to the location, purpose, type, or schedule of such active duty. In the 19th century, of course, when liberal factions like the Jacksonians were in power, this measure would have been considered to be blatantly unconstitutional, unwise, and immoral. But in 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court, reflecting dominant opinion among American politicians, sided with the Congress and ruled against attempts by governors in California and Minnesota to stop deployments of state troops overseas. Thus, the Montgomery Amendment ended any remaining ability of states to veto federal use of member state militias. By the mid-20th century, though, state militias had already been dwarfed by the National Army and Air Force that could function totally independently of the American member states. Why military decentralization is important. The Montgomery Amendment completed a long period during which a permanent, standing army gradually replaced an earlier model of militia power decentralized among state governments. The 18th century fear of centrally controlled federal troops had given way to support for state troops that were state militias in name only and subject primarily to federal control. The model of a decentralized army had originally been employed to limit federal military power, but physical and financial control of land-based military power is now firmly within the hands of the central government.